the you might say ultimate merit, meaning that which we most deeply deserve or are worthy of, the most you might say developed or the most refined expression of merit is to the realization of our own awakened nature, our own true nature. That's the goal, you might say, or that's the purpose, that's the function of all spiritual practice and meditation, is to realize your true nature. There was a request to speak a bit about the factors of awakening, the factors of enlightenment, those qualities of our consciousness that when cultivated and brought into, you might say, a synergistic and harmonious, balanced relationship with one another, accelerate the possibility of us seeing through the delusion, the ignorance, the habit of being asleep in a way, you might say, well, even our eyes are open. And when I say that, I mean not seeing the nature of things clearly. So I'd like to talk a little bit about these factors of awakening and see what we can go into through that particular theme. Human being is a stream of consciousness. What's sitting here is a stream of consciousness. The body-mind process is a stream of consciousness. Or you could call it a stream of energy. Consciousness is energy. Energy is consciousness. And that possibility in the stream of consciousness, what's happening now, is a stream of experience, a stream of consciousness. That's the way it is in every moment. The stream of consciousness, when we're in a dream state, appears different than this to some extent, mostly in that the bodily formation changes, but our mental formation, our perceptual sensory formation may be very much similar, although not as often sequential. It's more seemingly abstract, seems less coherent, perhaps, to the waking state. In the dream state, sometimes what's happening makes perfect sense within the dream state itself. The deep sleep state, the stream of consciousness becomes much more subtle, much more still and peaceful. Okay, but it's all still a stream of consciousness. Now, within the stream of consciousness, and this is what spiritual practice or meditation helps, you might say, cultivate the possibility of, is to see within the stream of consciousness your true nature, what you really are. And that true nature is freedom itself. Now, that true nature is freedom itself. Within that freedom, of course, there is joy, it's happiness, ease, and a absence of conflict, absence of disturbance, and absence of strife, stress, trouble. This is our potential. It's right here in what's happening. That potential exists. So in the stream of consciousness that you experience your life as, that potential exists. It's there for everyone, without exception. When we become more at ease in certain moments of our life, more contented, less caught up, less stressed, in a way we're actually opening towards that potential of full relief. Now, what is our true nature? It's the experience of full relief. So, in order for this kind of possibility to actually occur experientially, we need to open up. We need to open up our experience. We can open up our experience in all kinds of different ways. Life itself, as we live it, will, if we allow it, and however it's coming to us, it will open us up to some extent. Trauma is an unfortunate but yet powerful way that sometimes opens people up. Traumatic experiences to the body, traumatic experiences emotionally, traumatic experiences in relationship. But the two vehicles that have developed, one being much, much more, you might say, vast and deep historically, and the other much more a recent development, but the vast and much more deep and profound vehicle for this possibility of waking up, of opening up, is meditation itself. The other that's more recent, and obviously it's been around for quite some time too, we have our own westernized, or you could say Euro-westernized versions of opening up through different modalities of therapy. Lifestyle itself can be a vehicle for opening up. Sometimes the choice to live in a very simple, natural environment, a very, you might say, still tranquil, monastic environment, is an aid for this opening up. But now, no matter how you slice it, okay, this opening up needs to occur. There needs to be a receptivity to the possibility. If there's not a receptivity to the possibility, then we're vulnerable to living a distracted, preoccupied, impulsive, compulsive, habitual lifestyle. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Doesn't get us any, it's no use to us to judge those tendencies. Because those tendencies are part of the stream of consciousness as much as the awakening possibility. Or the enlightened possibilities in the stream of consciousness. So if we recognize that we are, at least to some extent, at risk for living in a distracted, reactive, habitual, caught up in, conflicted manner, and we have a caring response to that, we have a, you might say, interested or curious response to that experience, okay, we're already beginning to shift. What's happening there is the energy, the stream of consciousness, again, I'm suggesting consciousness is energy, energy is consciousness. Another possibility begins to crack open. We begin to see the possibility that this doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to necessarily live in a habituated, reactive manner. We begin to, as I like to say, differentiate responsiveness from reactivity. If we discover that reactivity is painful for us and at times painful for others, if we act those reactive tendencies out, and we begin to see the power of responsiveness, okay, we're already shifting. So the energy is beginning to shift. And here we have the first factor of awakening. It's called energy itself. Plenty of energy can be here at times for us, regardless of our age. Sometimes it's the idea that as you get older, you have less and less energy. I talk to some of my older friends, and they say, well, don't bother calling past 9:30 because I'm no good. You know, I'll be sleeping. See, but that isn't always the case. Sometimes young folks don't have much energy, and sometimes the older folks have a lot of energy. So the energy moves around, doesn't it? Einstein said it can't be created nor destroyed, it simply changes in form. Interesting revelation, wasn't it? Revelation, it was a revelation, it was an insight, a revelatory insight. Energy cannot be created nor destroyed, it changes in form. I'll leave that point for a moment and we can maybe come back to it. How does that directly apply to the awakening itself, the awakening potential? You may have some thoughts about that or feelings about that. So that factor of energy begins to reveal that it can be directed towards all kinds of different things. It can go into that distracted, habitual, reactive mode. And it can move into that responsive mode. Can move into a refinement, so it begins to center, you might say, in a certain sense. It begins to collect. It begins to become more refined. It begins to harmonize. And out of that harmonization of energy, because when we're feeling well, when we're feeling at ease, the energy of the body-mind process is, you might say, more harmonized. Out of that energy factor comes the next factor, and that's investigation. We all have investigation if we've ever experienced curiosity, if we've ever experienced interest in something, and we all have this factor arising in our consciousness almost every day. But we even, many times we might overlook it. We become interested in food, we become interested in places, we're interested in people, interested in music, interested in an activity. I was talking to a person today who's very skilled, I guess, and listening to him, it seemed that way to me at least, very skilled mechanic. He can take anything apart and he can put it back together, and you know, he's really good at that, a very good mechanic. He said, when I do mechanical work, he goes, I get totally into it, everything else goes away. He's describing meditation in a way. Everything else goes away. I'm totally into it. He goes, sometimes people around me are bothered, but I can't hear them. He seemed to like talking about that and enjoy that experience. Do you have that experience sometimes where you just get focused into something and everything else goes away? If you feel that you're living a life that has problems in it, you do this activity, you find all that goes away, you're freed from that. You don't have to go to the movies and focus on somebody else's life. That'll take you out of your story sometimes, won't it? If the movie's strong enough. Sometimes the movie's strong enough so that people say to their friends, you got to go see this movie. Because the movie was strong enough for the person, they say, you got to go see this, like this movie, Avatar. A number of people saying, you have to see this. I have to see this. I don't understand why I have to see that. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't, but you have to see this.
You have to see this.
You really do.
You really do.
We're getting around to it.
All right. Okay. Where was I?
Investigation.
Thank you. So investigation is happening every day to some extent. However, that interest and curiosity that we naturally experience when we're attracted to something like the movie Avatar, it refines. Our interest initially, our investigative skill initially is bias towards certain things. This is very, very, very common. It's interested in only actually, in a very, you might say, personal sense, it's only interested in certain parts of the experience of your own nature. So even as you're meditating, you can be just interested and willing to look at certain things. What's really meant by this factor of investigation is you begin to realize this is like a stadium light. You know what the stadium light does? When it comes on in the stadium, boom, it's all in the light. It opens up to moments at least, and it could be just seconds, milliseconds, where that investigative light is not biased, it's not prejudiced. And anything that's arising is in that scope of investigation. This is what joy comes from. I'm not just talking about the joy of having something happen that you wanted to have happen. The joy of looking forward to having time off and free time. The joy of giving something, which is wonderful joy. The joy of receiving something, another kind of joy. Yeah. The joy of being with people that you like. The joy of eating food that you like. The joy of a good night's sleep. I found a scarf in my dresser. It was in the back of my dresser. I found it about 3 days ago. And it was familiar. I couldn't remember. Someone gave it to me years back. Could have been many years, but anyways, there it was in the back. I pulled it out. I was like, "Well, this is nice. Nice scarf." I put it on. I've been wearing it since then. You know, I've been wearing it around. And then somebody said, "You look good in that." Well, there's the reinforcement, right? You look good in that. Certain kind of joy. But this joy of the factor of awakening, it comes from energy, it comes from investigation, particularly the investigation that opens into a non-bias, non-preferential. Yeah? It's not a judgmental, because preference is subtly judgmental. Preference is subtly bias. This goes away. So already there is a quality of freedom there, isn't there? When you are interested without bias in whatever's happening, whatever it might be, there's a certain space and freedom that's right there. Impermanent, but significant nonetheless. All these factors have within them the taste of liberation. We're not going to find out what freedom is unless you begin to actually taste it. And that's a metaphor, it's not a literal thing, because liberation isn't a taste in the sense that the taste of salt is a taste. So the joy is a joy that comes from seeing into what's happening deeply enough so that there's a connectedness with what's happening. The sense of feeling fragmented, the sense of feeling distracted, the sense of feeling uneasy dissipates. Myself, I remember before I even heard much about these factors, I was meditating intensively. And then years later, I realized I was experiencing these factors very powerfully, and I didn't think about what I was experiencing. I didn't name it, I didn't talk to anybody about it. But I used to meditate, and all this joy would come up, and then the bell would ring off, and then it was time to go eat. And I would just look at bananas and oranges. I wouldn't even eat them. I would just look at the bananas and oranges, look at the teacups, smell food. And this joy would just arise. And I'd find tears in my eyes. And I would be, wow, this is incredible. This is wonderful. I guess this meditation is a good thing. Because I wasn't feeling this way about apples and bananas and teacups and the smell of food before meditating. It's interesting. So that joy is within us. The joy isn't coming off of the teacup, off of the fan. Maybe the joy is somewhere in there in the stars and the open sky and the trees and the rustle of the leaves, the sound of the birds. But there's a joy inside of us that starts to become free as we open up. See, because actually, whether we know it or not, we can live in quite a closed way, enclosed, contracted way. And you can go through life, years of life, and live in quite a contracted manner. When people are looking for somebody to hook up with, and when my daughter was in high school, she used to talk about how these guys would just, you know, like they didn't even really know her, and they'd just come up, you know, maybe they had a little conversation, and they would say, "You want to hook up?" And that basically meant, "Do you want to go to bed?" You know, and she was like, "No." And I realized for myself that nobody was walking around saying that stuff when I was in high school, being that bold. I mean, there was other ways that you went about that stuff, but it wasn't just walk up. "You want to hook up? What's that about? I want to open up with you." Right? "I want to open up with you." I mean, that could be what's there. There's a seat up here on the couch if you want to, or if those are okay. Yeah. Whatever works for you.
I'll take the couch.
Okay. Open up to the nice soft couch.
Yeah.
But still, in this opening up, we can sometimes have that split separate from feeling contracted or closed. And so if we feel a sense of uncontractedness arise in our life in certain moments. We tend to view that as opened up. I'm now opened up. My heart is opened up. My feelings are flowing. My body's opened up. I'm sexually opened up. I danced and now I'm opened up. And that other way I wasn't opened up. Okay, this is a biased perception. Why do we say opened up means not contracted and closed up means contracted? Because that's a bias. Now, that's there until it isn't. That bias, that split. And yet, while even what I'm saying right now is true in the further refinement of what it really means to open up, in the sort of notion of ourselves that as contracted at times and limited and habituated, we begin to open up through the meditation, through therapy, through life, through nature. We begin to open up. And then we begin to realize that we have an extremely powerful force of consciousness that can refine even further. It's a refinement to realize that the energy of my life itself can turn towards investigation, and that investigation can turn in such a way that joy starts to arise, that I become a happier person, at least in moments. And I'm not happier because things are going my way. I'm getting what I want. What's happening is I become joyful because I'm opening up to my true nature. And that might be actually what I want. Some people do. In fact, in some cases, they want that more than anything else. And by the way, that can have an influence. If you pay attention to what you want, your desire system, you will see that every day to some extent, every year to some extent, every decade to some extent, it will be taking you to different places. Is that the whole journey of life? Is that what we're here to do? Live out our desires? You could do it. Nobody's going to stop you. I mean, you can go for it that way. After a while, it becomes a bit frightening to realize how responsible you are for your own life. Of course, while that can be frightening, it can also be amazingly provocative, powerful, evocative, challenging, and ultimately part of the liberation itself. Wow, this is up to me. What am I going to do? So that refinement of the energy, the investigation, and the factor of joy, these you might, as I talk about these energies, the energy and investigation and the joy, it's kind of like an upward and outward. Now that, if that just kept going, okay, I guess we would just expand. But the factors that balance this must be also understood and cultivated. And these are three. Concentration, equanimity, and tranquility. Now notice right now, if I said to you, what is your state of mind or state of consciousness right now? And you might go, how does that feel right now to be experiencing the moment as it is? Maybe there's a certain joy. Maybe there's a certain peace. Maybe there's a certain quality you say, ooh, there's a concentration there. Maybe there's a sense of balance, equanimity, calmness or peace, tranquility. And of course, none of this is recognized. None of this is observable without seventh factor of awakening, which is mindfulness or awareness itself. Okay. Awareness itself is called the linking factor that links all the others together, like the chain that links the pieces together. So concentration, again, not to confuse it with meditation, it's part of meditation, okay, but concentration is something that happens in meditation, and it's a very powerful factor. We can learn to concentrate. We can cultivate concentration. You can do it in any number of different ways. Meditation is just one way to discover what concentration is, but it's very powerful. And it really, really has a huge impact on the quality of our life to actually learn how to concentrate. OK? Okay, and in the teachings of the Buddha, there's a lot of different emphasis in different places on concentration. Okay. So, again, to be very clear, concentration is not the same as awareness. Two different things. Okay, awareness, just to give a sort of an image, awareness is the light of life. Concentration is that light becoming focalized through, say, a microscope and being directed towards an object, like the breath. Okay, so here's the light of awareness, the light of life, the light of our being, focalized through the microscope, telescope if you prefer, to see the object clearly. Object being whatever's happening. Does that make sense? So you see the difference? They're not separate, but they're distinguishable. And it's important to discern these. When we meditate, a certain amount of concentration tends to happen. When we do any activity, a certain amount of concentration tends to happen. But if you meditate intensively, if you do a retreat where you meditate intensively or continually for a whole day or two or three, what happens in some cases is this concentration factor intensifies, especially if you're doing a concentration meditation practice. For example, if you're doing a practice where you focalize entirely on one single object to the best of your ability, like the breathing, or like the body sensations, or like a mantra, which is when I first learned how to use concentration, was with a mantra. And I would do this mantra, and the mind and the body would come together, and it would get absorbed. And I would become blissful. I'd be ecstatic. I'd feel incredibly happy for hours afterwards. And then it would fade, and then I'd go back and do some more. And that went on for a few years. It was actually, for me at least, it was addictive, you know. But I was also learning about concentration. I just found that it was the most enjoyable place to be, and so therefore I was somewhat disassociated and somewhat disconnected from other parts of my life that really did need attention. So going from the mantra, which was basically, you know, you do it in your head, inaudibly, you know, you sort of whisper it, the experience of Vipassana was given, meaning initially for me, through the introduction to the breath meditation. And the teacher invited a focus on the breath in the belly, to feel the breath in the belly. Okay, and as soon as I went down inside the body, in this way that was being suggested, and felt the belly and felt the breath, it was like a whole other world opened up. And this world was both exciting to realize, but also it was troubling, because I realized there was all kinds of stuff down in there that I was completely not opened up to. And my life changed, boom, like that, on that day. And the mantra lost all attraction. There was no more interest in investigating the effects of the mantra for me. And it became this absorption in this opening to the greater depth and the nature of what I had not learned about myself. I realized that I was actually avoiding big chunks of my experience by staying in my mantra, that I got a very nice vibration going. And when that vibration was happening, I felt great. Well, I guess I was lucky in a way, because I didn't say, wow, that's actually, there's pain down inside there, there's trouble down inside there, there's lack of understanding down inside there, there's unconsciousness down inside there. I think I'll get out of there and go back to my little song in my head. By the way, I'm not bashing mantra meditation. It's a wonderful meditation. Okay, but if you really want to see deeply the nature of what you are, you can't just use concentration, because concentration must and will develop into that which helps support insight, support clear seeing, direct, clear realization. So the equanimity, another extremely important factor. We experience this sometimes in the body when we're sitting. The body will feel balanced, and it will not feel sort of misaligned. It will come into some kind of relative alignment. That's a sort of an equanimity. When the mind itself becomes equanimous, what happens is it stops reacting. Reaction goes away. It's absolutely wonderful for a period of time. It feels so clear internally. It feels so clear. It's like everything just clears out and balances and lines up. And that happiness or that joy that we were talking about earlier becomes much more subtle, because sometimes that joy of investigation, right, is actually imbalancing. Mine certainly was. You know. Getting excited about the color of the banana, you know, it was like very childlike, and it was fine, but it wasn't very refined. It was kind of shaky. In equanimity, the joy and the happiness goes much, much deeper. Because what's one experiencing? One's experiencing a kind of balance that doesn't tend to come about very easily or readily through other activities. If you notice what it feels like to eat a really, really good meal that's really, really well prepared with really, really good food, and you eat the right amount. You don't eat too much. You eat it properly. There's a good way to eat. It's called chewing your food well. That's what Mom said, right? Chew your food, Paul. Don't rush. So if the meal is eaten in the way you could say mindfully, meditatively, and the food is very good quality, and the ingredients are balanced, because there's science to this, there's an art to this, there's a quality of feeling that comes while eating the food and after eating the food. A balance. A kind of equanimity. Now, that equanimity is extremely surface as contrasted to the equanimity that comes in meditation. So I just want to give that sort of contrast. This equanimity, this factor of awakening, in the scriptures, in the Buddhist scriptures, is considered so important that it's described as the highest state for the human. Now, a state is not liberation, because liberation is not a state. But states, just like stages in life, come and go. Right? All your states of mind come and go. The stage of life called infancy, adolescence, puberty, young adulthood, these stages, they come and go. And within those stages, obviously, there's a multiplicity of states. Every day, there's so many different states that come and go. Yet in the Buddhist scriptures, it's said that the state of equanimity is so important, it's so exalted, you might say, that it's considered to be the highest state, the most refined state. And then, of course, there's tranquility, stillness. As you learn the art and the discipline of meditation, or any art or discipline, the martial art, the yoga, the art form, the violin, whatever it is, as you learn that, you discover what it means to find a stillness in your body. That stillness in your body is not imposed, it's not forced, you don't hold yourself in it, it opens naturally. That stillness or peace of body opens into the mind itself. Now when I say body-mind, I don't mean two different things. I mean a continuum. When I say body, I mean sensations. When I say mind, I mean the thought life, the imageric life, the space that we often, although this is limited, we often associate with our heads. We say that our mind is in our head, which is brain-based mind. How about this? The mind is wherever there is consciousness. The mind is wherever there is feeling. The mind is wherever there is sensation. The mind is wherever there is perception. It's much broader, and I would say perhaps more accurate description of what the mind is. And yet, for many of us, because we are conditioned, not just through the fact that most of our sense organs are centered in our head. We are also taught from young childhood to think about things as a way of knowing those things, understanding those things, and a way of living. We're taught to think, sometimes excessively. We become very focalized. Awareness, you might say, focalizes in our heads, which is both interesting, sometimes imprisoning, sometimes very, very fun, and sometimes very miserable, to be locked into the head, to be overly brain-based. The peace of tranquility, the balance of equanimity, even the concentration factor, can open us past our conditioning, whether that conditioning to be inclined towards being in our brains, the conditioning to be overly identified and involved in our body, the conditioning to be out of our body. This is another kind of conditioning, people who stay out of their experience of their body. Why would you do that? Well, here's one example. If this has been hurt, if this has been wounded, if this has been abused, if there's pain in here, I could disassociate from that by keeping my attention out of myself, keep my attention focused outwardly, focused on others, focused on things around me in my world. Also, it can be frightening to actually truly open up, because you don't know where you're going. You might be able to look at your life and you say, I know where I've been. I can look back. You don't really look back there, because the past isn't back there. The past, however it is recorded, is in here. It's not back there. That's just an idea. Just like the idea that the future's out there. It's not out there. There's nothing out there called the future. The future is a perception, a construct that arises here. And yet, when you begin to really open up, you begin to feel the law of impermanence, not think about it. You feel it. You feel it happening. That sense of control and a tendency to attempt to feel secure and even happy by controlling things, controlling yourself, manipulating things, gets challenged. And if it doesn't buck too hard against the truth, it softens. And sometimes it just goes away for a while, and maybe for good. And then this impermanence, this truth of change, this truth of transformation, begins to show itself. And this is a profound and liberating opening that's happening, because you're beginning to see the nature of what you are, relatively speaking. What am I, relatively speaking? Transformation. What am I, relatively speaking? A stream of consciousness. What am I? I am impermanence. Anywhere along that, you could say opening, there can be a reaction, there can be fear that arises out of the unconscious, there can be a pulling back from the truth, slow it down, you know, fear, uncertainty, doubt can arise. And there can be a sort of a pulling back, a contraction. Try to hold on, keep it familiar, don't let go. That's temporary. Most cases, if the bug, I mean this in the most positive sense, the bug of the possibility of liberation has arisen, even as a strong idea in the head, can't ignore it. So the opening begins again, you might say, or continues. Again, all of this happens in the field of awareness. Awareness is not even best described as a state, although it is considered a factor of awakening. This factor of awakening, which again, often the term mindfulness is used, is contrasted to awareness. Mindfulness is of the object. There is an awareness that mindfulness sits in. That awareness is sometimes called the ground of being, or in the Tibetan tradition it's called naked awareness, primordial awareness, intrinsic, inherent, unalloyed, spacious, freedom, as awareness. It's not personal. It's not limited to the body-mind process, although the body-mind process is within it. So what happens is the sense of the potentiality to be free from reactive, habitual, conditioned living begins to show itself through these factors themselves. A clear insight into these factors, just one of these factors, can change, you might say, the course of a person's life deeply. And sometimes it seems like a dramatic shift. I've watched people over the years that I've been involved in this sometimes do a short period of meditation, maybe just a weekend, and something happens. Something from beyond thought, as I was saying last week, something from beyond thought arises, an insight arises, a revelation of sorts arises, and the course of their life changes. They leave a relationship, they leave their job. They're drawn to intensive meditation, they go and do a long period. They go to India. They simplify, they sell their stuff. Usually through meditation, I do not find, maybe you would see this too, I'm not sure, but I do not find people doing meditation and really being touched by it and then going out and acting more wild and habitual. Usually it's the other way around, because the possibility of living in a way that's increasingly less conflicted and being free from the fear of death, being free from the fear of pain, very important, because those two are often associated with one another, fear of death, fear of pain. There's a reaction to the nature of what we are in the stream of consciousness. Yes, there is death. Yes, there is pain. Liberation is not about having no emotional, mental, physical pain. It's about being unidentified with that as yours. And as a bonus, you might say, or you might say as an additional icing on the cake, the pain tends to dissipate. The fear tends to dissipate. Because you're not holding it. Because you're not there in the same way that you thought you were there before. And that's literally what these factors of awakening do, is they pierce. You might see gradually at first, but surely, and eventually you see that it's all happening instantaneously. There's no actual progression. It's just instantaneousness, so-called over and over and over. That's what the moment is. It's the instantaneousness of this, 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 this. So that's probably enough for tonight. Let me stop there and see if you have any questions about any of that.